Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by Charter North Hospital providing treatment for mental health and addictive disease, by the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute promoting quality Alaskan seafood in the domestic and international marketplace, and by Mark Air and Mark Air Express.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly. Federal officials are on their way to Valdez for a look at the mounting damage caused by the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Prince William Sound. A major concern now is the safety of three fish hatcheries. Good evening, I'm Corey Flintoff. Also tonight, reaction from the legislature, what this means for environmentalist strategy on ANWR. And Steve Heimel talks with fishermen and townspeople in Cordova. A delegation of federal officials is expected in Valdez very shortly, sent by President Bush to give him a first-hand report on the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Claire Richardson has this update.
It was Dennis Kelso, commissioner of the Alaska Department of Conservation, who finally announced that the strategy for dealing with the spill had shifted dramatically.
We are past the opportunity to recover much oil. Now we are looking at defensive measures to protect particularly sensitive environments and cleanup. We are putting our primary emphasis today into defensive measures.
Instead of focusing on cleanup and control, crews are feverishly working to place protective booms in front of the Main Bay hatchery, the Armand Corning Salmon hatchery on Evans Island, and the Esther Bay hatchery. With the effort to make the hatcheries fortresses, Kelso says cleanup is now a second priority.
We are not neglecting cleanup, but we are making sure that if we have the opportunity for defensive intervention, that we do that first. If we can keep this oil out of those critical areas, then we will have accomplished something. But I want you to know that we are not going to be able to keep oil out of all the important areas by any means. The sound is very productive, it's highly sensitive, and we are certainly looking at a situation where most of those areas we're just not going to be able to touch. But the ones that we can, we're mobilized, and we're going to hit them as hard as we're able.
Cordova boats, dubbed by the fishermen as the Mosquito Fleet, will maneuver the booms into position. Other crews will try to deflect the oil into lagoons. Skimmers will then be used to scoop the oil out of the water. The president of Cordova Fishermen United is Jack Lamb. He was asked if his group decided to take control of the situation from Exxon.
Yes, to a certain degree, we felt like we had to take things in our own hands. But when we did that, everybody else realized that it was the same situation. Everybody had to get together and not do it on an individual basis. The boats were ready. We simply put them into motion.
The port of Valdez was reopened today on a limited basis. The first tanker full of North Slope crude oil was seen leaving the port at 1 o'clock. The Coast Guard has local pilots on board each vessel. Admiral Ed Nelson said refineries in the lower 48 put pressure on officials to get the oil moving again. At least a dozen tankers are waiting to take on oil. Alyeska Pipeline slowed the rate of oil entering the terminal to 800,000 barrels a day after Friday's spill. It's been estimated that the spill already has cost Alaska more than $10 million in lost revenues because of reduced flow through the pipeline. More losses are expected before the pipeline resumes full production. The Exxon Valdez remains grounded. More than 200,000 barrels of oil has been pumped from the tanker onto another one. Exxon President Frank Iarossi said all 1 million barrels should be removed by Saturday. Then salvage teams will work on a plan to float the heavily damaged tanker. Valdez Mayor John Devon said that his city had offered to stockpile equipment in case a disaster like this ever happened. But he said the oil companies assured him it wasn't needed.
I think it's quite clear right now that this area, not just Valdez, but possibly Cordova and Tetlik and possibly even Whittier, are faced with the destruction of our entire way of life. This oil must be cleaned up, and it must be cleaned up as soon as possible. That sounds kind of ironic since we're now into the fifth day, and in our view, there really has been very little of substance that has been completed.
Devons is worried that the area will not recover from the disaster.
And we hope that Exxon will honor their pledge, and we hope that the President of the United States will see fit to make a declaration of disaster for this area. because we're afraid that when all is said and done, that maybe when those of you of the press find something else to interest you and you leave and go home, and there's no longer an eye on Valdez, maybe some of the commitments will not seem as important.
Exxon officials will head to Cordova for a meeting tonight with fishermen there, and the Secretary of Transportation, the head of the Coast Guard, Senator Frank Murkowski, and other top officials will fly into Valdez to gather information. They will then advise President Bush on the situation. In Valdez, I'm Claire Richardson.
State lawmakers returned from their Easter break today and offered a variety of reactions to the Exxon Valdez accident. House Oil and Gas Committee Chair Mike Davis of Fairbanks said he visited the spill site and believes the oil industry was totally unprepared for this kind of environmental disaster. And Senator Al Adams said the industry's assurances of safe operations were obviously false.
And we have been believed in the past that when we gave them their permits that they would be able to jump in there and make a sort of a cleanup such as this. But it's been delayed now by 4 days, and I believe that this is absolutely inexcusable for a spill as this large to not be contained by this time.
Meanwhile, some of the oil industry's regular backers in the legislature tried to mount a defense. Representative Walt Furness asked his colleagues not to be too hasty to castigate the oil industry for an unfortunate chain of events. And Senator Jack Coghill says there's plenty of blame to go around. A few years ago, Coghill introduced a bill to wipe out the State Department of Environmental Conservation. But now the Nanana Republican says DEC should have been paying more attention to regulating the operations in Valdez Harbor instead of picking on placer miners.
The placer miners are good neighbors, and the amount of dollars that we're spending monitoring them out of business, we should have been monitoring the Valdez Harbor.
Meanwhile, legislation removing an oil industry tax break known as ELF appears ready to move out of one Senate committee this week. Senate President Tim Kelly says the Prince William Sound spill will put pressure on the Senate to move the ELF bill. Also in Juneau today, Governor Cooper took aim again at the oil industry response to the spill, and Attorney General Doug Bailey said state investigations are proceeding on both the civil and criminal levels. Peter Kenyon reports.
Governor Cooper says he spoke with Environmental Protection Agency Administrator William Riley Monday and informed him that the cleanup efforts were by no means under control. Cooper says it's important for EPA and other federal agencies to see the devastation in Prince William Sound for themselves so they can appreciate just how inadequate current federal and state laws are in terms of dealing with environmental damage on this scale. Cooper says there needs to be a clear chain of command on site in Valdez to coordinate the immediate response, including, quote, someone who knows what they're doing, unquote. The governor was nonplussed by reports that the weather was hindering the cleanup. He said this is normal Prince William Sound weather and suggested the industry had already blown its chance to take advantage of the calm weather right after the spill. The governor also has reservations about the decision to resume tanker traffic in Valdez Arm.
Because they failed miserably to look at the implications of a major oil spill, and they still aren't ready to respond to one. If we had another one tomorrow, they still wouldn't be able to respond to it.
By Tuesday afternoon, the supertanker Arco Sag River had successfully maneuvered past the oil slick and was tied up at Valdez Harbor. Governor Cooper has also asked the National Transportation Safety Board to include a representative of the state in the investigation of the cause of this grounding. Attorney General Doug Bailey says the criminal division already has a presence in Valdez because the accident may have involved violations of state law. Bailey declined to give specifics of an ongoing investigation, but he indicated that attention is directed at the captain's activities, both before and after leaving Valdez Harbor. Exxon officials have admitted Captain Joseph Hazelwood had a history of drinking problems, and news reports have listed multiple arrests and revocations of licenses for driving while intoxicated. Hazelwood was not on the bridge when the ship ran aground, leaving an unqualified officer in charge of the vessel. In addition to the criminal investigation, the state is gathering information that may be useful in a variety of civil cases that could result from the spill. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
The nation's leading environmental group said today that the Exxon Valdez disaster is a new arrow in their quiver to fight oil development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Joel Southern has the story from Washington.
The 10 groups, ranging from the National Audubon Society to the Sierra Club to the Wilderness Society, lambasted oil industry promises to prevent disasters like that in Prince William Sound. Brock Evans of the Audubon Society called the Exxon Valdez oil spill America's Chernobyl. He said environmentalists have worried oil companies would fail to come through in emergencies ever since completion of the Trans-Alaska pipeline from Prudhoe Bay. He said the Exxon Valdez incident should be a red flag for proposed oil development in Anwar.
The fact is that the legislation that's now being battled over does have the same kind of safeguards that they promised us 16 years ago. They say, we're going to override the National Environmental Policy Act because don't worry, we're going to have the best environmental safeguards money can buy that we can do. Trust us, trust us, trust us.
Tim Mahoney, chairman of the Alaska Coalition, thinks as Congress debates Anwar, the Exxon Valdez spill will tip the scale against the industry's environmental claims.
With every passing day, they say there is another passing day, proving that all our critics and all their suspicions were wrong. Well, this weekend, we were proved that we were not wrong, and we believe that will give a new impetus to the Congress to rethink the environmental promises of the industry.
Former U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson, now with the Wilderness Society, argued President Bush, a strong supporter of environmentally sound development in Anwar, should now take a second look. Though Bush has sent his top environmental, transportation, and Coast Guard officials to oversee the oil spill, Nelson said Bush should go a step further.
I think what he ought to do is, in addition to that, is to say, I'm recommending we put a freeze on any further development, and particularly the Arctic coastal plain, which is so sensitive and so highly productive biologically. And if he would do that, that would be a great help. The minimum he can do is send somebody up there.
Scientist Lisa Speer of the Natural Resources Defense Council argued there's just too much evidence about damage from oil spills for the Anwar debate to go on.
Tanker accidents are a routine part of this business, and so are oil pollution events onshore and offshore. Routinely, you see oil spills on the North Slope on the order of 450 to 500 spills per year. In addition, we have hundreds and hundreds of polluting events to the air and to the water. I would submit that, in fact, what happened at Valdez is not unique. It has happened before, and it will happen.
Environmentalists are not the only ones worried. Governor Steve Cooper, who backs environmentally sound drilling on the North Slope, admitted on national TV last night the Exxon Valdez incident will take its toll on development efforts. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Joel Southern in Washington, D.C.
Exxon and state officials are headed for Cordova this evening for a town meeting. Steve Heimel's there waiting for them.
Normally, at this time of year, tender boats are sitting in the water offshore, waiting for the go on herring fishing. But no boats at all sit offshore today, and fishermen are in port. In part, it's because they're here for the meeting. But in part, it's because nobody knows if there will be a herring season with oil on the water. So the fishermen are in the local hangouts, talking among themselves about what the spill could mean for them. They're talking about money, of course, and what they may make in compensation for lost fishing from Exxon. And, of course, they're trading rumors and suspicions. The oil is going in the opposite direction from Cordova, but fishermen say that's just for now. What about when the westerlies hit? Then there's the sightings of oil on beaches around the 10 tankers, waiting for Port Valdez to open. Local business owner Kelly Waverling says this is combined with the fact that those tankers are suspiciously high in the water.
The size of the spill, the direction of its motion, and its growth. We have been getting reports of oil in Knowles Bay and fingers of oil up into Port Gravina, which is separate and apart from the oil spill that we've been tracking in the middle from the tanker. We've also seen on video that all the tankers that are anchored here are riding extremely high, much higher than we think they should be if they were properly ballasted.
The questions for Exxon are sure to include this issue, as well as the question of compensation and what Exxon Shipping President Jack Iorossi means when he says all reasonable claims will be honored. They tell me several hundred are expected. The meeting will happen in the biggest room in town, the high school. For APRN in Cordova, I'm Steve Heimel.
As damage from the Exxon spill intensifies, the cleanup efforts becoming more labor-intensive. And while Exxon is hiring local workers, other agencies are making lists of volunteers. So many people have come to Valdez from out of town that agencies are turning them away. But as Robin Martin reports, they can't dampen volunteer enthusiasm.
Jeff Rogers has a pickup truck with room for two more people, and he's leaving Fairbanks to clean up oil in Valdez. He says during the last Good Friday disaster, Alaskans pitched in from all over the state to help communities along the coast, and now it's time to do that again.
It's my home. It's our oil spill, and it's not going to go away, and everything seems like it's a terrible event down there. All I've heard about is Steve Cooper's upset, Exxon's upset, everybody's upset, but it's going to take people to go down there and get to work and clean it up.
Rogers has checked with Job Service in Valdez, who is hiring locals first, and he has his name on a list with the Department of Environmental Conservation. But he doubts they will call him while he's in Fairbanks, and he's getting more and more impatient.
And instead of just standing around looking silly, I want to be handed some tools or whatever it takes and get sent out to a beach and start cleaning up.
But Valdez is swamped with oil spill experts, reporters, and local volunteers. At the Bird Cleanup Center at Copper Basin Hall in Valdez, things are still slow because not that many birds have been recovered. L.J. Evans recommends that volunteers thinking about coming to Valdez just hold off for a while because they aren't needed yet and there's no place to put them.
Certainly no hotel rooms. People have rented out their spare bedrooms and so forth, and there's no rental cars. It's really pretty much madness.
But Rogers remains undaunted.
I'll sleep on the floor. I'll eat Wonder Bread and cheese. I'm just fired up about this, and I want to go.
There's no shortage of volunteer help, according to Dave Klein of the National Audubon Society.
Well, we're receiving calls here at the National Audubon Society from people throughout Alaska and actually around the country. We receive calls from places like New York City and Philadelphia and so forth, people anxious to go to Valdez to help clean up oiled birds. We are taking names and addresses and keeping a roster of these volunteers in the event they're really needed, but at the present time, we're recommending they not go to Valdez just because there is no room in the inn, so to speak. There's just no place to accommodate people.
Pam Bergman of the Interior Department is also keeping a list, but she won't call anyone on it until there is some more coordination among agencies to train and assign volunteers.
We don't want people going out there helter-skelter trying to capture birds. The area is pretty much restricted and off-limits. If everybody goes out there helter-skelter, it's going to be a big mess.
Bergman says it's too dangerous for untrained volunteers to go after sea otters, which look cute but can be hostile. The last thing anyone wants is a human casualty from the cleanup effort. Reporting for APRN, I'm Robin Martin.
This week is, of course, the anniversary of another great Alaskan disaster, the Good Friday earthquake of 1964 that devastated Valdez and much of south-central Alaska. Taken with the Exxon Valdez disaster, it makes a good point to reflect on Alaska's emergency preparedness. In part two of our special series, On Uncertain Ground, Robert Hawk reports Alaskans have learned a lot in the last 25 years. But there are still some serious gaps in the modern era of emergency response.
Alaskans have always taken pride in being able to handle most any situation, but sometimes even decades of planning isn't enough to avert disaster. The oil industry, for example, has long been promoting its readiness to handle large oil spills, saying since the early pipeline days, it has the technology and safeguards to prevent large-scale damage. But the ongoing tanker oil spill in Valdez has prompted bitter complaints from the state government, from environmental groups, and especially from Prince William Sound fishermen like David Grimes. State agencies are critical of what they say is slow response to the spill. Grimes says it shouldn't come as that big of a surprise.
Well, the fishermen knew, the governmental agencies knew, Alyeska knew, and Alyeska's seven parent companies knew that there never has been an adequate oil spill response capability in Prince William Sound.
Usually, though, it is government, not private industry, at the helm when it comes time for chaos control. Last winter, an unusual alliance was formed between various bureaucracies in Juneau and remote villages that had lost their power and water from the extreme cold. The situation got bad enough for Governor Cooper to declare a state of emergency.
I am requesting all Alaskans to exercise necessary caution and to be alert to the real dangers of this protracted cold snap.
The state response to the cold spell was lauded by some, but other officials at the time had complaints about poor communications and not being able to quickly assess the damage. The cold weather, for the most part, was a short-lived period of trouble, but in the wake of oil spills, vicious weather, and earthquake memories, the question still nags. What if something really big happens? Another devastating earthquake or other widespread calamity? Irv Martin holds part of the answer as director of the Alaska Division of Emergency Services. Martin is the man in charge of statewide disaster response, and he warns you shouldn't assume the authorities will come rushing to help.
If there's a catastrophic event, there are not enough ambulances, EMTs, and doctors to alleviate it. More often than not, you're going to have to get to the medical and to the shelters yourself because they just don't have enough people to come out and pick you up. You have to have some individual standalone capability like generators, water and food, that kind of stuff.
Experts say another major earthquake in the Pacific Northwest is inevitable. Martin says if destruction is widespread, like it was following the shock and tidal waves of the 1964 disaster, his top priority is to maintain things like roads, airports, and communications.
I rely upon the American Red Cross to pay for the primary individual and family needs. I take care of local government facilities and services, which are critical, like your utilities, your water lines, your heat, your lights, and that kind of stuff, to get them up and functioning.
But while Martin says he depends on the Red Cross, that agency says its emergency account is empty. Joyce Murphy is the coordinator for the South Central Alaska chapter of the American Red Cross. She says contributions to the nonprofit group have been falling for years.
The sad part about our local chapter and our state as such is that our emergency services here are broke. The state has not put a whole lot of money into it because it has taken low priority. We've not had a major incident for over 20 years, 20, 25, 26 years now. And the Red Cross chapter is not well known in the community, and folks are not supporting it very much. Part of it is because they don't know about it, and part of it is because all the other agencies needing money. I think Red Cross has not done enough to go out and toot its own horn and say, hey, folks, we are the disaster services that will be there when you need us.
Murphy says if need be, they would be supported by the National Red Cross, but that would take time, which becomes all important during catastrophes. Irv Martin says money is not a real problem. You take care of what's needed during and after an emergency. But Martin concedes that Alaska's oil wealth makes the federal government look hard at any requests for disaster relief.
Because we are one of the only states that I'm aware of who have a disaster relief fund, then the federal government assumes that we can take care of most of our problems ourselves. A $500,000 disaster in Montana may qualify for federal assistance from the president because they don't have a disaster relief fund. A $500,000 disaster in the state of Alaska would never qualify for federal assistance. They consider us to be the blue-eyed Arabs. We have a permanent fund, we have uncommitted cash reserves, and we have a disaster relief fund. I have to expend or commit somewhere between $2 and $4 million before the federal government would even consider providing relief assistance to the state of Alaska.
Good, 124 over 82.
One thing that may prove more valuable than any amount of money during a disaster is blood for transfusions and surgery. But as the economy has shrunk the past few years, so have the amount of blood donors. Dale Goodlow with the Blood Bank of Alaska says his donor list has dropped by 4,500 people since the mid-1980s.
We'd like to have more blood donors in the donor base to respond to these emergencies that we've been talking about. Because when emergencies happen, they necessitate immediate action. So if we had these people in our donor base, we would have an easier time responding to that emergency.
Officials with Anchorage Area Hospital say in the event of a high number of injuries requiring transfusions, the supply of tested blood would last about 6 hours. After that, untested blood would have to be used. Many types of disaster would put excessive demands on local hospitals. Chris Erickson is a spokeswoman for Providence, the state's largest hospital. She says it would be fairly easy to overcrowd all the hospitals in Anchorage, including Providence.
Yes, there is obviously a point where we could be overloaded if it's not that inconceivable when you figure that at top we could take 400 people. That only means we have beds. That doesn't mean we have doctors and nurses and equipment and things to take care of them. That means we could put them in here and lay them down somewhere. But in that event, you tend to use everyone in the hospital and anyone in the community that can help to start caring for people.
Erickson and others refer consistently to the state and local emergency response plans as their guidelines for avoiding problems. In the case of overcrowded hospitals, the contingencies call for public schools to become aid stations. But in some respects, the planning is in limbo. Will Abbott, Director of Emergency Services for the Municipality of Anchorage, says the city is in the process of working out a new comprehensive disaster response plan. But in the meantime, if something happens, he'll have to rely on a decades-old civil defense strategy that has been updated only once in the past 10 years. Abbott is among the first to agree there are gaps in the city's preparedness. He says things like chain-of-command personality disputes tend to crop up, as do communication snafus. Abbott says short of the real thing, exercises are the best way to work out the problems. He says some simulated mayhem is set for next month when an emergency drill originates at Elmendorf Air Force Base. Abbott is unsure what the pretend tragedy will be, but he says it's bound to be drastic.
Yeah, I didn't think they're going to blow up the gym or something out there and you know, take out about 100 and some folks. It's a typical exercise that we have out there. Remember, we used to crash C-130s into the side of the personnel building all the time. That was a favorite one.
Drills are one thing. Reality is something else. Abbott says if there's anything that keeps him up worrying at nights when he thinks about possible future earthquakes, it's what will happen to new buildings on the Bluff area of downtown Anchorage and homes in the Turnigan area built since the 1964 earthquake. Abbott is among many critics who question the logic of building in areas that have proved to be geologically unstable. One concern, especially regarding earthquakes, is what will be done with the 38,000 or so students in Anchorage schools if disaster strikes on a school day. Tom Bibeau, risk management officer for the school district, says the district's general plan calls for all students, especially elementary grade students, to stay at school, and parents will be asked not to rush to the schools. That's the policy. Bibeau acknowledges it may be wishful thinking.
They'll want to go to the school, and that's going to create traffic in the roads. Obviously, the plan would ask that they not do that, but it's going to be difficult for us to say that they won't. They're going to do that.
Bibeau says he feels comfortable with the school district's overall disaster readiness, but he points out that principals at some Anchorage schools could put emergency planning higher on their priority lists. That's the trouble with disasters, though. You just never know when the time will come. Will Abbott makes no excuses. He says it's impossible to get ready for a cataclysm.
Some things I don't think you can ever get fully prepared for. How do you get prepared for an 8.4 earthquake? You really don't. You get prepared to take on as much as you can and do all you can, but if you were truly prepared, then you'd be able to almost negate it, and you can't.
Will Abbott, director of Anchorage's Emergency Operations Center. The school district's Bibeau agrees. He says the real key to being prepared doesn't lie with the community or the government. It's the responsibility of the individual. In Anchorage, I'm Robert Hawk.
And that's Alaska News Nightly for this Tuesday, the 28th of March. We had reports tonight from Claire Richardson of KCHU in Valdez and Robert Hawk of KSKA in Anchorage. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Cordova, Peter Kenyon from Juneau, and Robin Martin from Fairbanks. Our Washington correspondent is Joel Southern. Diana Derby is our engineer, technical supervisor is Chris Bedalek, and I'm Corey Flintoff.
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, promoting social progress and economic development for people throughout the state, by the Tundra Times, keeping you up to date on statewide Native issues at 274-2512, and by Mark Air and Mark Air Express. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
It's the end of the road.
Welcome to the end of the road, brought to you once again from beautiful Homer, Alaska, where life is as good as it probably can get around here. I'm Tom Baudette, your well-behaved host, and minding his manners on the keyboard is my partner, Johnny B. How's it going, JB?
Just fine, Tom.
Good for you. You know, spring is in the air and the sap is starting to rise.
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by National Bank of Alaska, offering Alaskans convenience in banking, by HB Systems, makers of the HB Systems computer, Valdez, Alaska.
Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly. More tonight on the Exxon Valdez oil spill, state and federal investigations of the captain and third mate, fishermen's reactions from Cordova, and the precarious state of the tanker itself, still laden with crude. Good evening, I'm Corey Flintoff. Also tonight, concern about the spreading oil spill goes beyond Prince William Sound. And Kodiak gears up to fight the wasteful fishing practices that helped bring about the pollock closure in the Gulf of Alaska. The captain and the third mate of the tanker Exxon Valdez have refused to speak with federal investigators about the accident that spewed 11 million gallons of crude oil into Prince William Sound. A National Transportation Safety Board public hearing into the cause of the grounding has been delayed until further notice. Claire Richardson reports that the alcohol test given to the captain was administered 9 hours after the accident.
Captain Joseph Hazelwood and third mate Greg Cousins had their lawyers by their side when the National Transportation Safety Board interviewed the pair on Tuesday. Investigator William Woody said the two men talked about their history with the company and their experience with ships.
However, on advice of their counsel, they have declined to discuss the events of the casualty.
Woody says lawyers for Hazelwood and Cousins want to study state and federal laws before they allow their clients to speak on the issue. However, the helmsman, Robert Kagan, on watch for only minutes before the grounding occurred, did talk to investigators. Apparently, the Coast Guard approved the vessel's permission to change into the inboard shipping lane to avoid ice. But the Exxon Valdez actually was a half mile outside of the lanes. And instead of turning left, Woody says the third mate gave orders to turn right, heading straight into Bligh Reef.
This was followed by what he described as a bumpy ride. At the immediate end of the bumpy ride, or just as it was stopping, he got notice from the third officer for hard left rudder. Then, a few moments later, he remembers getting various orders from the master of the vessel.
That information conflicts with Exxon officials who reported earlier that the master had not been on the bridge when the grounding occurred. Woody revealed that the Coast Guard officer who boarded the vessel 2 hours after the grounding suspected the captain of drinking.
The Coast Guard officer boarding the vessel about 2 o'clock in the morning said that he detected a smell of alcohol.
But even though there was an alcohol testing kit on board, Coast Guard Officer Mark DeLosier was unaware of that, and the captain was not tested by a state trooper until 9:30 in the morning. Woody says there are audio tapes of the Coast Guard's conversations with the Exxon Valdez, but he hasn't heard them yet. And he adds a sophisticated radar system was intermittent near Bligh Island that night, even though the weather was clear. But Valdez fisherman Hunter Krantz says the Coast Guard has often spotted his 72-foot crab boat miles past Bligh Island and asked him to move over to allow the tankers more room.
They can't tell me that they are sitting up there and can't see that boat when they put it on a collision course and didn't take it back off. Why didn't anybody sit there long enough? That it was only 42 minutes from the time of the transfer to the time of impact. Can you tell me that that guy was so bored he couldn't spend an extra 40 minutes there watching to say he's not changing course? We better do something about it.
The NTSB had scheduled a public hearing on the cause of the accident to begin next Tuesday in Anchorage, but Woody said it now has been delayed indefinitely. The Alyeska Pipeline Terminal continues to come under fire for the slow response to the spill. Terminal Supervisor Chuck O'Donnell admitted that Alyeska did not notify the Department of Energy Conservation that a barge used to transport boom and other oil spill equipment was down for repairs.
In our contingency plan, if a piece of equipment is going to be out of service for 3 days or more, we are required to notify the state regulators. We didn't. The reason being... Please, let me continue. The reason being is because all the equipment was there and right on the shoreline, if you will, and was ready to be put back on the barge.
As to whether the contingency plan was inadequate for such a disaster, O'Donnell wouldn't say.
It was an unfortunate situation that we did have that equipment off the barge. We fully intended to repair the barge as quickly as possible and return the equipment back onto it. But I think my folks did a heck of a job. I really am proud of them. They did a lot in a short amount of time, to respond to the spill site.
Estimates now put the size of the spill at 500 square miles. In Valdez, I'm Claire Richardson.
Officials admitted in Cordova last night that no way exists to clean up the amount of oil that Alaska tankers carry. They told a tense meeting of fishermen that the plan all along had been to use chemical dispersants. If the aim of the Cordova trip was to soothe the feelings of the fishermen, it failed. Steve Heimel prepared this report.
I'm not here to
salve you. Exxon's Don Cornett did not make any progress spreading any salve he might have brought. Those fishermen were very angry and worried about their livelihoods. Officials had planned to fly back to Valdez after an hour and a half. They hastily changed their plans when they perceived the heat level in the Cordova High School gym, where virtually everyone in town was gathered. By 10:30, Coast Guard Commander Steve McCall was beginning to admit, well, yes, it was an awful lot of oil. An awesome amount gushing from that ship in the first hours, more than he had ever laid eyes on before.
I have never seen that much oil in my life before, and I've been doing this for 15 years. That is a tremendous amount of oil. And at the rate it came out of the ship, like I said, I had one of my people, and Dan Lawn from ABEC in Valdez, was on board that ship by 3:30. And to paraphrase what they said, the oil was boiling out of the side of the ship from all the holes on the starboard side. And was basically, the oil pouring out was like 3 or 4 foot higher than the seawater outside. I mean, there must have been close to 200,000 barrels of oil released from that ship within 3 hours. And it's your worst nightmare.
Exxon officials and Alyeska President George Nelson said it's common knowledge in the industry that the only way to deal with an event like this is dispersant chemicals.
With this size of spill released in this size of speed, what you're basically talking about is the use of dispersants.
George Nelson. In Cordova the next day, people said what they heard sounded pretty much like what they'd been hearing already on the radio. They had virtually no confidence that Exxon would be giving them adequate compensation anytime soon, or even that oil company practices would be tightened up much in the future. Faced with the likely total wipeout of their herring roe pound fishery, the potential ruination of the market for any fish they take, and an enormous peril clouding their pink salmon hatcheries, most are just beginning to fathom what this could mean. Kim Hager, who's fished here since he was a kid.
It's been great for us. It's something that we've all paid into, and it's been some of the greatest marine minds in the world are here, and they've developed a sound that's, with abundance of wildlife and fish and stuff. That, you know, there's no other place like it. I've been all around the world, and there's no place as beautiful as Prince William Sound. And it's clean and it's pretty and, you know, there's just nothing like it. And it's just all gone down the tubes. It's just, you know.
For APRN in Cordova, I'm Steve Heimel.
Representatives of environmental groups held a news briefing in Valdez today, blasting the slowness of the cleanup and linking the disaster with other oil development issues throughout Alaska. Bob King has more.
I'd like to briefly take exception with some Exxon statements that you've all heard, that there's no relationship between what's happening here and the industry's plans for development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Yesterday, for example, Mr. Cornett, and I'm quoting, said that, quote, ANWR and this incident, it's a nice word for the disaster, by the way, are unrelated, unquote. On the contrary, I believe there's a direct and immediate relationship between the two occurrences.
The Sierra Club's Jack Heshen was just one of many environmentalists who linked the Valdez spill to proposed development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The lesson, they said, was that industry promises just couldn't be trusted.
We heard from the industry that it's perfectly safe to ship oil down the West Coast in supertankers. Do not worry, they said. Trust us. If there's ever a spill, we'll clean it up effectively and speedily. Well, you can all see what a sham that argument was. And now we're being asked to believe that industry can move into the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, one of the world's pristine wildlife habitats, into the very heart of the refuge, with little or no risk to the unique wildlife and the wilderness values there. I submit that we're getting the same song and dance on the Arctic as the industry gave us here back in the early 1970s.
Others also called for a halt to the government's OCS leasing schedule, specifically for proposed development in Bristol Bay and Chukchi Sea. Nancy Lefko of the American Wilderness Alliance also called for a national policy to cope with such disasters.
The time has come for the establishment of a procedure for declaring national environmental emergencies.
We ask that Congress set up a fund to cover the cost of immediate responses to environmental emergencies, cleanup, assessment, and rehabilitation.
But others wanted even stronger action to deal with the situation at hand. Among them was Mike Lewis of Earth First, who demanded immediate action.
Since Alyeska and the owner companies cannot guarantee the safety of the oil tanker fleet, tanker traffic through Prince William Sound to the Alyeska Pipeline Terminal Facility must be stopped immediately. Since there exists no method of safe removing oil through the environmentally sensitive lands and waters of Alaska, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline must be shut down immediately.
Lewis did not directly respond to questions about a possible blockade of the Alyeska Marine Terminal, but he did say that his group would not remain complacent.
The people and the wildlife of Prince William Sound are backed up against the wall, and I remind you what happens to a grizzly bear when it's cornered. It fights back. Earth First!
In Valdez, I'm Bob King.
President Bush, meanwhile, is sticking by his endorsement of oil and gas development in Anwar. Bush told reporters yesterday that he sees no connection between the Exxon oil spill and the search for more oil in Alaska's eastern Arctic. In his words, they've been shipping oil out of there for a long, long time and never had anything of this magnitude or this concern. Under the Anwar drilling plan before Congress, oil from the refuge would be channeled into the Trans-Alaska pipeline and could keep Valdez in business as the pipeline terminal port for another 30 years. Stay with us on Alaska News Nightly for more on the Exxon Valdez disaster, including fears that it'll spread to other regions. Up next, the precarious process of unloading the stricken tanker. While fishermen race against the spreading crude to protect their livelihoods, another drama is unfolding at the source of the spill, the Exxon Valdez. Exxon workers are engaged in a tricky and potentially explosive balancing act involving the crippled supertanker, surging seawater, and 2.5 times the amount of crude that's already fouled Prince William Sound. Peter Kenyon reports.
The tanker is of very great concern, and it's been overlooked too much.
DEC Commissioner Denny Kelso. For the last 2 days, Kelso, Governor Cooper, and Exxon officials have all agreed on one point that's largely been overlooked in the news media. The biggest potential danger facing Prince William Sound is not the 250,000 barrels of oil already in the water, but the much greater amount that could still come gushing out and make this spill look tiny. At their daily news briefings, Exxon officials usually start with an update on the transfer operation that had all but filled the Exxon Baton Rouge by late Wednesday. Exxon said 390,000 barrels had been successfully transferred, and by Thursday, a second tanker, the Exxon San Francisco, should be in place to take on more of the oil. Right now, there's 610,000 barrels still on the crippled tanker and a very real potential for another spill. What makes this operation so unstable is the devastated hull of the Exxon Valdez and its precarious perch. Kelso says 30% of the hull is damaged, and some of the holes are a full 120 square feet in size. While the company is moving as fast as it can to get the oil out of the punctured tanker safely, Exxon is only too aware that one false move could upset the delicate balance that's keeping more oil out of the Sound right now. One mystery for some had been why, with more than half of the holds fractured, only 1/5 of the oil escaped. Exxon official David Parrish says that's because some of those punctured holds still have oil in them. When the original oil spilled out, it was replaced by seawater, which, being denser, pushed the oil to the top of the holds. And as oil is pumped out of those holds from the top, more seawater moves in to displace it. Kelso reports that Exxon workers are filling empty ballast tanks with water as they remove the oil to try and maintain equilibrium. The dangers include the potential that the ship will be stressed by the shifting load and actually crack and spring more leaks, or that it will become too buoyant and roll or capsize. Either way, the Prince William Sound disaster would be multiplied. State officials are becoming critical of Exxon on one aspect of the offloading operation. As of late Wednesday morning, observers who flew over the tanker reported that the protective boom around the Exxon Valdez, which had been damaged in the high winds earlier this week, was still not secure around the vessel. Kelso says that boom is the first line of defense against further spills, and DEC has told Exxon it has to be repaired.
Not only have we been clear about it, but we have added it to the agenda of the Operations and Coordination Group. We, of course, are going to require that it be replaced.
DEC Commissioner Denny Kelso. Exxon now estimates that if all goes well, the Exxon Valdez should be emptied of crude by Friday evening. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Worries about the Exxon spill have begun to spread beyond Prince William Sound. Should the slick move through Montague Strait, it could be picked up by currents that would carry it to Cook Inlet. Joe Gallagher reports.
Dr. Ray Highsmith, a marine biologist with the University of Alaska, has studied the currents that move through the Gulf of Alaska, and he says if the slick moves out of Prince William Sound, it will most likely end up in Cook Inlet.
The typical patterns of water flow continue, and if the oil comes out, the oil slick comes out of the western entrance to Prince William Sound, then it's almost certain, in our view, to continue moving toward the west. And again, because of these Coriolis forces, they're called, tend to make water to deflect to the right, could very well enter Lower Cook Inlet and Kachemak Bay. We think that's a very real possibility.
Highsmith says there's no way to predict when the oil might reach Cook Inlet. However, he said once the slick leaves Prince William Sound, people should prepare for the worst. The university biologist says he isn't exactly sure how long it would take the oil to reach Cook Inlet, but he estimated it would probably be between a couple of days to a week. Highsmith said he's also worried that the oil is going to head towards Kodiak Island and the Shelikof Straits. He said the university plans to set up monitoring stations in Cook Inlet in an effort to keep track of the effects of the oil spill.
We hope to set one up on the south side of Kachemak Bay in the vicinity of the Kitsitsa Bay Laboratory. And we plan to watch mussels, the blue mussel or the edible mussel. And we've also made preliminary collections at various sites in Prince William Sound. And we're doing so in Resurrection Bay, and I think as well at Kodiak, so that we can follow the time course, and with periodic sampling, we can test the tissues of those mussels for hydrocarbons. So even when it gets to the level that you might not see it real obviously, we'll be able to tell whether or not organisms are picking it up.
Dr. Ray Highsmith of the University of Alaska. Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
People all over Alaska are searching for ways to help with the oil cleanup in Prince William Sound. They've heard there may be jobs available, and so they start calling for information. Pat Fremming is the manager of the Anchorage Job Service Office. She says they've gotten hundreds and hundreds of calls, and many people have come to the office, but right now she doesn't have a job for them.
The only way we're going to have a job is if a job order is listed with us. As of this date, no one has placed a job with the Anchorage Job Service Office that would be related to the Valdez oil spill.
The place that does have a job order related to the Valdez spill is Cook Inlet Tribal Council. They run a computerized talent bank. A contractor called looking for about 1,000 laborers, and they've been processing applications all week. Leroy Bingham is the director of community services for Cook Inlet Tribal Council.
Well, what we've been doing is screening Alaska Natives and American Indians to refer to an oil field service contractor for work out in the cleanup in the spill around Valdez. We've had several hundred people that have been through here making applications.
Part of the application process is a urinalysis and a commitment to bring your own rain gear and warm weather clothing. Cook Inlet doesn't do the hiring. They send the completed applications to the contractor. You're listening to Alaska News Nightly from the Alaska Public Radio Network. Still to come, more than 200 jobs on the line in Wrangell. Up next, Kodiak gears to fight the forces that closed the Gulf of Alaska's pollock fishery. Community leaders in Kodiak are mobilizing in reaction to the shutdown of the Gulf of Alaska pollock fishery. They're pushing to reopen the fishery, and they're also taking aim at the Seattle-based factory trawlers responsible for the early closures. Charlene Parent has the story.
In a meeting yesterday, Kodiak fishery, government, and business leaders laid out a five-point plan of action. Number one, now that pollock is a prohibited species, they're calling for an emergency meeting of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council to determine an allowable bycatch of the fish. Secondly, at the council's April meeting, they'll ask for a fall pollock allocation. Fishermen and processors say there's plenty of fish out there, but they say resource managers determine the pollock population using inaccurate and sketchy data. Fisherman Dave Harville.
When I question a resource manager, they actually, if you go down through the years, they actually have a pretty good track record, even though we don't like to admit it. But in this particular case, their track record stinks. And a lot has to do with observers, a lot has to do with funding, a lot has to do with the simple fact they just won't listen to us. I don't know what it all is, but we do know the pollock are there.
Without another allocation this year, pollock processing plants will have to lay off employees. That's going to have a severe economic impact on Kodiak, according to the manager of Alaska Pacific Seafoods, John Sevier.
I don't know what it's going to mean for the boats, but I can tell you what it's going to mean for the employees of the processing plants and the retailers in Kodiak. You're probably looking at about 2,000 people that are going to be unemployed between September 1 and December 31, where normally they'd be employed. And that's a pretty substantial amount of people. And I think that even the lowest paid cannery workers are still making $600 a week or $700 a week. So you can imagine what kind of a financial impact that's going to have on not only the town of Kodiak, but maybe the rest of the Gulf of Alaska.
Point three of the plan is to push for an onboard observer program to be in place by January. Without observers, resource managers can't get reliable data, and they can't monitor the factory trawlers. The factory trawler sucked up more than half the year's quota in a few short weeks, reportedly by processing only the roe of the fish and dumping the remainder overboard. In point four of the plan, Kodiak is calling for a ban on the practice of roe stripping. That's expected to help reduce the huge intakes of the factory trawlers by slowing down their production. But ultimately, Kodiak doesn't just want to slow down the factory trawlers. They want the Seattle fleet out of the Gulf of Alaska entirely. As a step in that direction, Kodiak's asking for the support of the congressional delegation and the governor's office to get an allocation system in place that would give preference to shore-based processors. Dave Woodruff, owner of Alaska Fresh Seafoods, says the shore-based preference will Alaskanize the fishery.
Yeah, it's just the same as we displaced the Japanese out of our black cod fishery, moved them out. We finally moved a joint venture out, and now best utilization of that stock is to come ashore, and so that's what we want to push on. We want to displace the American factory trawler, if you will, like we did the foreign entity, and try to move them off into the Bering Sea or some other place.
Kodiak's proposals will be brought up at the April meeting of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, and Chris Blackburn of the Alaska Groundfish Data Bank says what happens there will be watched closely by coastal communities around the state.
We're setting a precedent here that Southeast is interested in, so is Bristol Bay. The chain is concerned. So this is not a localized issue by any means.
Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
More jobs went by the board today as Wrangell Forest Products announced the indefinite closure of its Wrangell sawmill. Rhonda Litchwark has details.
The mill's contract operator, Steve Seeley, says the mill, which employs 207 of Wrangell's 3,000 or so residents, will be closing because it has no logs. When contacted Wednesday afternoon, Seeley said that optimistically the mill could reopen as early as the 15th of April, but he says that depends on whether the mill has enough logs by then and is granted its tidelands fill permit. The mill currently has an application before the Army Corps of Engineers for a permit to dump its wood waste in a tidelands fill. Rumours have been rife in Wrangell for several weeks now about when the mill would close and how long it could close for. Wrangell Chamber of Commerce President Bill Privett says a long closure could be devastating to the town.
It means that we have
29 to 30% unemployment in Wrangell. How long this lasts will bear directly on how it's going to affect the economy. I think it'll be very clear that if it's a very long closure, we're going to have some serious impacts. It's been in the past that we've gone through approximately about a year and a half closure, and it was devastating the economy. I feel comfortable that they will open back up again, that they will get their waste problems resolved. I can only hope that it's soon so they can get back in production out there.
That was Wrangell Chamber of Commerce President Bill Privett. Wrangell retailers spoke about the effect of the closure on their businesses.
It'll go down considerably from what it is now.
How long a closure? Say if the mill only closes for a month or two, does that create a big impact?
Well, it does, but we can live through that. But something that would be longer than that would be, you know, we'd have to really take a look to see whether it was viable to still stay in business or not.
This is kind of a luxury. People are not going to come get their hair done unless they just have to. So it's bound to affect it. You know, it'll be slow, but we'll make it through it.
You know, everybody's got to eat, but the big thing is they change their habits of eating. This sort of thing, it changes the whole aspect of the way people do provide for their families. One of the big things is here a couple of years ago when the mill went down for 6 months or so, it made a real drastic change. And of course, some people left and some people stayed. And I think that a majority of the people that have been in Wrangell for a long time will stick it out.
Yeah. Well, it's obvious that people won't be spending money because they won't be making it. So the downtown merchants are going to have less business. People buy the paper, but it'll affect advertising, I'm sure. The merchants just won't have the advertising revenue. It's kind of sad, too. Actually, in a downturn, they need to advertise to get business, but they've got to come up with good sales and good gimmicks, and that's hard to do in a town this size.
With no definite indication of how long the closure might last, Wrangell residents appear to be facing an anxious and uncertain future. In Wrangell, I'm Rhonda Litchwark.
And that's Alaska News Nightly for this Wednesday, the 29th of March. We had reports tonight from Claire Richardson of KCHU in Valdez, Bob King of KDLG, also in Valdez, Joe Gallagher of KBBI in Homer, Charlene Parent of KMXT in Kodiak, and Rhonda Litchwark of KSTK in Wrangell. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Cordova, Peter Kenyon from Juneau, and Sue Burris from Anchorage. Our engineer is Diana Derby with production assistance from Larry Yarrow. Chris Badalek is engineering at KCHU in Valdez. I'm Corey Flintoff.
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by the Sheraton Anchorage, where your comfort and well-being come first, and the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, promoting quality Alaskan seafood in the domestic and international marketplace. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Good evening, station. This is the APRN Actuality Service for this Wednesday, the 29th of March. We have one piece of brand new material for you from Robin Martin in Fairbanks, and a note. There will be a channel change for morning news service. Tomorrow and Friday will be on Channel 11. That's Thursday and Friday. Morning news service will be fed on Channel 11. Please make sure your program directors know about that. Just a bit of news. As you heard so far, Bob King and Chris Badalek drove down to Valdez this morning. They are now there. Chris is engineering. Bob is volunteering at KCHU. And I understand